Well, distinguished colleagues and friends, it does behove me to say at the outset that this is a truly wonderful occasion. Did we ever think, so many of us, that as we envisage the many possibilities of our individual and collective futures, that we would be attending, and in UCD's case, hosting, a 10th anniversary conference celebrating an agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland? For their work and wisdom throughout the past decade, and particularly in the organisation of this conference, I'd like to pay tribute to Professor John Coakley and his colleagues in UCD's Institute for British Irish Studies at Multos Annos, John. Equally, while it falls to me now to introduce one man, let me take this brief moment, please, to salute the efforts of so many public and behind-the-scenes figures who work so hard for so long to bring peace to Northern Ireland. We are and continue to be in your debt. If it hadn't been done already, I might well now go on to say that this is not a time for sound bites, but the hand of history is upon us. And what I will say is that I hope you, our distinguished conference delegates, will understand if I say that for me, this is an occasion tinged with sadness, as it is likely to be the last time that I have the opportunity as UCD President to welcome formally to UCD on Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, TD. I'll say immediately, Taoiseach, there will always be a welcome at UCD for you. And I dare say you'll get the same message throughout this island, a neighbouring island, and larger land masses east and west in the days and weeks ahead. My thoughts go back inevitably to the first time I welcomed you formally to the campus in the context of our UCD 150 celebrations in November 2004, when you did us the honour of opening the UCD William Jefferson Clinton Centre for American Studies. And in a characteristically visionary initiative, the Clinton Centre was funded by the government, which you led, in recognition of President Clinton's contribution to the peace process. Is there not a certain symmetry then that we find ourselves today in the Clinton Auditorium discussing a climactic moment in that process? Shortly afterwards, I had the pleasure of accompanying you on a trade mission to China, and that it was an eye-opener for me to see how enthralled the Chinese were with the Irish success story, the high esteem in which our leader was held, and the doors he opened for Irish business, all as a result of our Asia strategy put in place by Taoiseach, who saw the importance of Asia to Ireland's future developments before most others did. And I remember distinctly the Taoiseach addressing and engaging with a packed auditorium of students at UCD's partner institution, the prestigious Fudan University in Shanghai, and one enthralled interpreter saying to me, "He is so charismatic, he is like Clinton." And rumour had it he attended constituency clinics in Drumcondra within hours of returning to Dublin. Not quite from the Great Wall to the North Wall, but pretty close. These are personal memories, but I think you'll all agree that, like no other politician, it is the genius of Bertie Ahern that he has combined and fused so successfully the personal and the political, the local and the global. Bertie is a man of vision and a man of action, and just consider three examples briefly. The peace process, Ireland's role and influence in Europe and Asia, and Ireland's strategy for science, technology and innovation. He's a man of peace who built bridges where previously counterparts would have hesitated to look for outlying planning permission. He is a man who saw the opportunity for a small country such as Ireland to serve as an honest broker and a key influencer in the European project, and who, as I mentioned above, was a decade ahead of his international counterparts in appreciating the emerging economic importance of Asia. And with his keen appreciation that peace has to be secured as well as delivered, so in the case of economic prosperity, the Taoiseach has appreciated, like few others, that to secure prosperity, we must invest in science and technology research and development. He's the man who gave us early in his first term as Taoiseach the Programme for Research in Third Level Institutions, a groundbreaking partnership with Chuck Feeney's Atlantic Philanthropies, who's supportive of the Institute of British Irish Studies, I should acknowledge here today. Later in the same term, the Taoiseach gave a Science Foundation Ireland, and in his second term, he drove through the strategy for science, technology and innovation. Now, these three initiatives combined should, given the appropriate ongoing support, serve to secure the legacy of that prosperity which Bertie Ahern did so much to establish. There is so much more that could be said. I pass over with the briefest of passing mentions of his domestic political achievement in becoming both our youngest and our second longest serving Taoiseach. A man of peace, a man of prosperity and progress, a man of vision, a man who walked with kings but emphatically never lost the common touch, a man who combines the best of global leader and true dub. Indeed, to coin a phrase, he is a global dub. Friends, I give you on Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern.
Thanks very much, President, and thank you once again for inviting me to UCD, to this great university, to this great campus, and thank you so much for your kind words. I think this institution is a wonderful place, and under your leadership and that of your colleagues and those who've organised today, it goes from strength to strength. And I suppose, President, I have to say to you, the reason I've been back here so many times this last number of years is because so much has been happening, so much new developments, the numbers continue to grow, the progress across all faculties continues to expand with such enormity, and I just today particularly want to wish you and all your colleagues here in the governing body and all the faculties every success, and I do hope a lot of the initiatives that we've been involved in these last 10 years continue to develop at this great university. I want to say it's a particular honour for me to be here today with the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Sean Woodward, and to thank him for the huge amount of commitment and work that he has put in and putting in and will put in into the future, into the ongoing work of Northern Ireland. And we thank you, Sean, for all of that. And I want to thank all of the ambassadors here, the distinguished guests and distinguished speakers that I share this conference with. And thank everybody for the huge level of organisation that's got into it. This is the event that we decided on and agreed on that would be the only event in the Republic to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. So I think I, like you, am honoured to play a part in it because it has been a wonderful 10 years, a wonderful experience of working on the Good Friday Agreement and all that's happened from St. Andrews and which will happen on into the future. So to have been invited to address you here today at the Institute of British Irish Studies as we celebrate these days, the 10th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement is a great occasion. And it is appropriate, President, that we use these days to reflect on what has been achieved and to articulate a vision for the future. That's what I'm going to attempt to do in the next period of time. The 10th of April 1998 stands out as a watershed in our history and will into the dim and distant future of history. It was in some ways an ending of a sustained conflict and the culmination of long and intensive negotiations. And it also marked a new beginning, a new era of peace and of mutual respect. And the negotiations leading up to the agreement took place against a backdrop of sectarian murders and political discord and the spate of killings, and particular the murders in March of 1998 of close friends from both religions, from either side of the so-called divide, Philip Allen and Damien Traynor at Points Pass, affected everybody deeply and brought home to all of us just how high the stakes were. We faced enormous challenges to remove the causes of conflict, to remove the legacy of history, to heal the huge divisions of the past. And the only way this could be achieved was through a comprehensive agreement, taking into account the totality of relationships on these islands, taking on the big institutional issues that for so long had caused such alienation. And we also needed a new ethos, an ethos of tolerance, of reconciliation, of equality and mutual respect to underpin, as the President said in his words, the agreement. And many of the commitments made in the agreement invoked taking difficult decisions in the white heat of negotiation in the final days leading up to the 10th of April 1998. And they involved difficult choices for the negotiators, having to accept unpalatable elements of the agreement in recognition of their importance to others. Some elements, especially the early release of prisoners, were deeply painful at a personal level for those who had lost loved ones in the conflict. It was our collective best effort in that spirit that we recommended to the people north and south to support agreement. And we had, of course, huge resources of leadership. Some of those who were central to the process are no longer with us. The great Mo Molan and the great David Irvine made enormous contributions and are sadly missed both professionally and personally. John Hume and David Trimble, who led the negotiating teams, took enormous risks for peace and were rightly honoured as Nobel Peace Prize winners. Gerry Adams and Mark McGuinness showed great leadership in bringing the movement with them, first to the negotiating table and ultimately to the centre of a new power-sharing administration in Belfast. And never to be underestimated, the challenge that they had to take on and successfully implement. In later years, Dr. Ian Paisley, Peter Robinson and others in the Democratic Unionist Party showed equal vision and leadership in negotiating and then implementing the St. Andrews Agreement that led to the restoration of the institutions and the hugely positive situation we all enjoy today. President Clinton gave us Senator George Mitchell, who was with us every step of the way. The President also gave much of his personal time, as did his successor, President Bush, and our special envoys and their administrations gave a huge amount of commitment. International support for the process, including through the European Union, the International Fund for Ireland, was and continues to be vital. And of course, John Alderdice and Monica McWilliams and General Don de Chastelain and many others have continued and made very significant contributions in various capacities right up to the present day. In the period up to 1998, we were fortunate to build on foundations laid by my predecessors over many years, and notably John Major and Albert Reynolds, who helped bring about the IRA ceasefire in the autumn of 1994. Perhaps most importantly of all, in Tony Blair, I had a partner as British Prime Minister who was prepared to work tirelessly for many years to settle our age-old question. And the framework we achieved back 10 years ago was, of course, truly comprehensive. It is worth recalling today, President, that the full range of commitments agreed included constitutional change for both Britain and Ireland, inclusive power-sharing institutions in Northern Ireland, the establishment of North-South Ministerial Council, the North-South Implementation Bodies, the British-Irish Council, and the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference. In few international agreements, and we have many, have you such a range of issues, such a comprehensive range of issues taken on in one agreement to try to take all together. I suppose you would think that's why it's taken us 10 years to get here, but at least it was the fact that everything was put in to that agreement back on this week 10 years ago. There were also crucial provisions relating to human rights, the transformation of policing and the criminal justice system, the decommissioning of arms, the normalisation of security arrangements, and of course, as I mentioned, prisoner releases. And a crucial element was measures to promote reconciliation, addressing the needs of the victims of violence. And while many of the obligations have been fully implemented over the past 10 years, the solemn obligations to pursue reconciliation and to help victims remains ongoing by their very nature. They will remain at the core of our future work, in my view. Ladies and gentlemen, I can well recall Senator Mitchell noting in the final days and just after we had signed the agreement in the afternoon of Good Friday of 1998 that it would take a lot of effort in good faith for a long time to achieve the goals of this agreement. In the intervening years, there have been Those breakthrough days which attracted the newspaper headlines across the world and which will be written about in history books and the generations to come. But there were many important moments which hold a special place in our collective memory, culminating on that famous historic day in May of 2007 when Dr. Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness took office in Stormont. Before that, there were many other days when, without fanfare or publicity, the process of building trust, developing relationships and changing attitudes took place. And this took weeks, months, years of quiet work by ordinary people on all sides, slowly, painstakingly and steadfastly creating the space in which all enemies could come together and take forward the process of peacekeeping and reconciliation. As the troubles recede into history, and thankfully they do, we can more clearly look at the quiet work that went on for decades, both before and after 1998. We're profoundly grateful to all those who worked and who still work every day for peace and reconciliation. In the bleaker days, President, during the past 10 years, when progress was slow or things appeared to be moving backwards, it was important to remind ourselves of why we were there. The strongest motivator was the knowledge that the implementation of the agreement was what the people on the island want us. The resounding endorsements, North and South, in the referendums of May of 1998, which took place after the agreement, underlined to all the parties involved that an inclusive approach underpinned by mutual respect and forsaking all forms of violence was what the people desperately wanted after generations of troubles. It was a particularly proud moment for me as Taoiseach when the referendum here in this jurisdiction was carried by a majority of over 90%. And that decisive result confirms the openness and the willingness of the Irish people to commit to new arrangements that would make and take account of all traditions and viewpoints on the basis of fairness and equality. And it was a brave decision for the electors of the North and a brave one equally for the people of the South. They did so because they appreciated that the provisions of the agreement were balanced. In their view, in my view, it was a fair deal. And so much has been achieved, President, since 1998. The inclusive power-sharing institutions in Northern Ireland, the Assembly, the Executive, are now working to address the day-to-day concerns of the people. They're talking about the bread-and-butter issues that John and I and everyone in politics and Martin would deal with every day. The issues of education, of health, the issues of infrastructure, the issues of maintaining and sustaining employment, and nobody really notices, but that's what democratic politics is meant to be about. A key moment, of course, was the recent agreement on the budget, the programme for government, the investment strategy, major achievements by the new institutions. The North-South Ministerial Council, the North-South implementation bodies are back fully operational. Following the Patent Commission and the Criminal Justice Review, the policing and the criminal justice system in Northern Ireland have been totally transformed, with Sinn Féin giving its full support to the peace process of Northern Ireland. There's now a fully accountable police service serving the community and increasing representatives of the community playing a major part in it. And of course, these changes did not happen by chance, but rather because the Patent Commission did an excellent job and the governments and the political parties, especially the SDLP, worked to ensure that its recommendations were implemented. Crucially, and after many years of arduous negotiations, in 2005, the IRA formally ended its campaign of violence, and the independent international commission body verified that it had decommissioned the totality of its arms, their quote. 10 years ago, Northern Ireland was scarred by heavily militarised barracks and watchtowers. Many border roads remained closed. There was a very large troop presence across the north. Today, the physical landscape is transformed, the hardware of conflict is gone, and the remaining troops are confined to barracks. And throughout all of this process, the relationship between Britain and Ireland has been transformed from one of difficulty and disagreement to a vibrant, modern relationship based on strong economic and cultural links and a shared vision for a peaceful future. We are also, President, continuing to develop the relationship with our nearest neighbours in a whole range of other ways, including through the British-Irish Council, which was established under the Good Friday Agreement to foster East-West links. Already the council has played a significant role in developing the relationships between all of the administrations on these islands. I was honoured to host a recent summit meeting in Dublin. The venue, the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham, carries echoes of so much of our shared history, while the substance of the meeting showed a clear path to new and developing relationships for the future. Of course, the attendance of leaders from Cardiff and Edinburgh were a clear reminder that 1998 saw more than one significant constitutional innovation. As well as the Good Friday Agreement, that year also the devolution settlements in Scotland and Wales. The future evolution of those devolved institutions will have important implications for everyone on these islands into the future. So, President, ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of this agreement, it was about securing lasting peace in how the two traditions on this island live and interact with each other. When we agreed the North-South aspects of the agreement, we envisaged a North-South Ministerial Council that had the capacity to make a difference and improve people's lives north and south. And this is why we wrote in that participation in the council would be, and I quote, one of the essential responsibilities attaching to relevant posts in the two administrations. We reflected further on this, of course, in the St Andrews Agreement. And we've since turned our good words into positive action, especially over the last few months. I was proud to lead our ministerial team at the North-South Ministerial Council in July of last year. It was the first occasion in over 5 years for ministers on both sides to sit around a table together, and we had a genuinely open and wide-ranging discussion on a whole list of issues too long to mention. We had further wide-ranging discussions in Dundalk in February, including on issues that will affect the all-island economy. And already we have seen significant new initiatives. We're implementing a massive programme of joint investment in infrastructure, including a major new interurban road between Dublin and the North West, as well as the route between Belfast and Nairn. We also hope to see further improvements in the Dublin-Belfast rail service emerging from future meetings of transport ministers from north and south. We have agreed on a new integrated cross-border approach to development of the northwest of the island through the North West Gateway Initiative. And this involves a holistic approach, including local government, industrial promotion, transport and spatial planning, and workforce development and improving public services. An example of where this can lead was the recent approval by government funding for a study into closer links between the University of Ulster and Letterkenny Institute of Technology. We're also cooperating and investing in new initiatives in the areas of higher education and research, issues very close to your heart, President. A major new cross-border innovation fund was recently announced by the Northern Ireland Minister for Finance and Personnel, Peter Robinson, in cooperation with Minister Micheál Martin. Both administrations are also cooperating closely in their approaches to major European Union funding for research under the new FP7 programme. The single electricity market is already a reality, successfully launched by Ministers Nigel Dodds and Minister Eamon Ryan last November. And that's a crucial step in addressing our future economic prosperity and in linking us into the British and wider European energy systems for the future. We're also present looking at other crucial economic issues, such as the all-island labour market, which will be the subject of a major conference later on this year, cross-border mobility issues, cross-border changes in the banking and telecom sectors, to name only a few. Important and groundbreaking work is underway in cooperation in health, in education, in regional development, in environmental protection, in spatial planning. We have agreed to begin the restoration of the Ulster Canal in Cavan for Mana and Monaghan, and I hope that in the future that restoration will follow the full route and restore the link between the Lagan and the Shannon systems and fulfil the huge potential for regeneration and tourism in that part of the border region. At our next plenary meeting of the Council, we'll have a substantive discussion on tourism, building on the excellent progress already made by Tourism Ireland in marketing the entire island. We'll also address the key strategic issues of climate change and energy security. And there are many other projects underway, just too numerous to mention, but to give you a flavour just of the extent and the range and the depth of what is happening. They're being carried forward by ministers, by departments, by agencies, north and south, every day, as well as the north-south bodies. And they're changing the lives of everyone in this island for the better. So, President, as we reflect on our journey from conflict to peace, we'll naturally accentuate the many areas where positive progress has been made. However, we must not be complacent. There are still challenges ahead, and while the loyalist paramilitary groups have begun processes of transformation, they have unfortunately not decommissioned, and a minority of people remain wedded to criminality. For our part, we remain committed to helping loyalist communities, moving beyond the conflict of the past, and to share in the peace and prosperity which is the birthright of all the people of Northern Ireland. We applaud the leadership shown by so many people in those communities who are moving on and are working daily with the rest of us to make a better future, and I thank them for the work they do. There are also small, unrepresentative groups on the other side who would propel us all back to a time of despair and anguish. They'll continue to face the full rigour of the law on both sides of the border. Of course, there are also issues from the past that need to be addressed, and I want to mention some of those. I welcome the continued focus on victims, including the recent appointment of a new Victims Commission in Northern Ireland. We'll also continue our work with victims in the South. There's also ongoing consideration of the many difficult issues from the past that are still causing hurt and division. The group headed by Dennis Bradley and Robin Eames is looking at those issues, and they have my best wishes in what is an immensely difficult but important task. And to build on the peaceful environment that has been created, we now need to move forward to the next stage of the process, when elected representatives locally take over democratic responsibility for policing and justice in Northern Ireland. And this is an absolutely integral part of the agreement at St Andrews that led to power sharing and for all party support for policing. It shall be implemented in good faith for that reason alone. But it also matters to society. It matters that the political leaders of Northern Ireland take responsibility for tackling crimes on their streets. It matters that people feel safe in their homes. It matters that investors can work with a stable, fully functioning government. And the maintenance of law and order is a fundamental task of any democratic administration. And that is why we need to complete the devolution of policing and justice to the Northern Ireland Executive. Both the Prime Minister and I made clear when we met recently that we believe that the time is now right to proceed with this final step. And when I had an opportunity yesterday of talking to Prime Minister Gordon Brown, that is something that I know he is committed, as I am, to trying to see through. And along with supporting the investment conference, that will be the focus of the two governments in the coming weeks and months. It will be the last piece of the jigsaw that will give us the durable peace and prosperity that we've been working for the last number of years. There are also other outstanding commitments from St Andrews that I'm confident that we will see implemented in the near future. Discussions are underway on the establishment of the North-South Consultative Forum. Irish Government has had very positive discussions with the social partners and other interested groups. Their input can add huge value to the existing North-South dialogue by highlighting important social and economic issues that affect ordinary people. As is already the case in the social partnership process in the South, we expect to put forward a proposal on the consultative forum for consideration by the Northern Ireland Executive in the coming months. The respective legislative bodies, the Oireachtas and the Northern Ireland Assembly, also have had preliminary discussions on the establishment of a North-South parliamentary forum. And at the same time, we've seen very positive engagement between the Oireachtas and the Assembly at committee level, with a number of visits, including elected representatives of all shades of opinion. And I hope we will see further progress in this issue soon, as well as on the unionist participation in the East-West parliamentary framework. For its part, ladies and gentlemen, the Oireachtas established an important dedicated committee to oversee the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. Apart from its very important subject matter, the committee is also significant for the participation alongside TDs and senators of MEPs elected in Northern Ireland. And there are other steps which must also be taken if we're to live up to the full aspiration of the agreement, which was to strive in every practical way towards reconciliation and reapproachment. The scourge of sectarianism is still all too evident in Northern Ireland, ladies and gentlemen. The peace wall still stands as an effort to our aspiration for a peaceful, democratic society. They are an affront to what we've been trying to do, and we must try to remove them. There are no easy answers. This will be the work of a generation, perhaps more than one, to overcome. And this problem must be tackled every day, every week, every month into the future. Of course, leadership on the issue must come from the Northern Ireland Executive and from the local communities involved. The Irish Government hoped to play our own small part through a dedicated anti-sectarianism fund, which was included in the programme for government last year and which was recently launched by the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Dermot O'Hearn. We will also continue to place reconciliation and the elimination of sectarianism, indeed racism and other forms of hatred, at the centre of our policies. So, ladies and gentlemen, another important challenge that must be faced is that in which faces all societies, to provide prosperity and opportunity for all of our people. That places economic and social progress at the heart of public debate and of government policy. We have seen this in Northern Ireland in recent times, in both the nature of the electoral contests of 2007 and in the policies of the executive that was elected. It is a profound and welcome change in the politics in the North. The task of developing the economy, including an all-Ireland dimension, is crucial to the future. We've created the circumstances where a person's opportunities are not determined by their political outlook or their religion or from where they come from. Whether from the Bankside or Shankill, everyone should have a fair chance to succeed in life based on their own ability, their own hard work. And that is now possible. If we're to maintain peace and progress, we must make sure that promise comes true. As well as the Northern Ireland Executive, this work must involve both governments, our friends in the United States, the European Union and other countries represented today by their ambassadors, and we thank them for being here. It must involve and engage the people of the South in business and trade unions, the community, the voluntary sector, the arts, the public sector and throughout society. We do not have a separate past from Northern Ireland and we cannot have a separate future. The durable success of the peace process, the future prosperity on everyone in this island, North and South, are essential to all our futures. The next phase of the work is underway, with a range of North-South cooperation I mentioned earlier, also the forthcoming International Investment Conference in Belfast next month. The Irish Government will continue to work with the Northern Ireland Executive to develop the economy, improve society right across this island. And it is profoundly in all our interests, from Bantry to Ballymena, and it's of course impossible to predict the future. But we can learn from the past. Much of the debate has been on lessons learned that might be applied to other conflicts. It's a complex question that are clear difficulties in applying the answers we found in Ireland to other parts of the world. Today, however, we should focus on the lessons learned as they affect future policy and developments on this island. What we have learned and what it does mean for us here at home. First and foremost, we have learned the futility of violence. Thousands of people died. Thousands more were injured. Thousands of families were left broken and grieving, without fathers or mothers, sons or daughters, brothers or sisters. That happened in our country, ladies and gentlemen. It happened in our lifetimes. Whatever the circumstances, whatever the motivation, whatever the hurt felt, whatever the hurt caused, none of that violence was ever justified. None of the hatred, none of the conflict advanced the interests or aspirations of our people on any side. It was the ending. It was the ending of violence that allowed progress to happen. So let us honour the dead by ensuring that never, never again do we see violence used to advance political aims in our country or any part of it. The Good Friday Agreement itself expresses this best, and I quote, "The tragedies of the past have left a deep and profoundly regrettable legacy of suffering. We must never forget those who have died or been injured, but it can be best to honour them through a fresh start in which we firmly dedicate ourselves to the achievements of reconciliation, of tolerance, of mutual trust, and to the protection and vindication of the human rights of all." End of that great quote. What is important to state clearly and unequivocally that there should never again be violence in the islands. We must also take action to make sure that that is the case. It is our task now to ensure that the conditions that created that conflict never occur. That is the core of the Good Friday Agreement and what it is all about. The primary purpose of the Good Friday Agreement was, of course, to settle the conflict, that had ravaged the North for three long decades. But it also created a framework for the core relationship that went to the heart of our historic quarrels, the relationship within Northern Ireland, between North and South, and between Britain and Ireland. All previous attempts to settle those issues had ultimately failed. The Act of Union of 1801, the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921 ultimately failed because, as we can see with hindsight, they contained the seeds of their own destruction. Perhaps chief among their problems was that they were not democratically accepted by all the traditions on this island. There was always a minority who felt that they had lost. And I would argue, President, that this is my most fervent hope that the 1998 changed all of that. We have found a way of developing a relationship that accommodates everybody and threatens no one. It accords legitimacy to all aspirations, whether for Irish unity or continued union with Britain. It permanently removes any suggestion, however illegitimate it may have been, that violence or the threat of violence is justified by reference to the democratic wishes of the Irish people. And for the people of this state, the amended Article 3 of our Constitution sets out that new and unalterable context. And I quote, "It is the firm will of the Irish nation, in harmony and friendship, to unite all the people who share the territory of the island of Ireland in all the diversity of their identities and traditions, recognising that a united Ireland shall be brought about only by peaceful means with the consent of the majority of the people democratically expressed in both jurisdictions in the island," end of quote. And for those of us who believe in Irish unity, and I passionately do, I will always be one of those people. There is a clear way forward through seeking to persuade those who do not share our beliefs. For those who believe in the union, there's a constitutional guarantee that the principle of consent is inviolable. And for everyone in Northern Ireland, there is positive recognition that their birthright to identify themselves and be accepted as Irish or British or both as they may so choose. In that way, the agreement positively empowers and respects each and every person on this island. One of the saddest developments in recent decades, President, has been the reduction in the number of people in the North from a Protestant, Unionist and Loyalist background who regard themselves as Irish or as both Irish and British. And this is a huge loss, I would contend, to that community as well as to the entire island. It is a position that I believe is changing as the Unionist community grows in confidence and as respect grows for their unique tradition and for the position that they hold on this island. And that is a profoundly welcome development for all of us. Through the process of building trust, building reconciliation, the Good Friday Agreement has created new possibilities, possibilities that go beyond the old certainties and the unrealistic dreams. Those new possibilities are about the unity and friendship of the people. The last 10 years prove yet again that history does not stand still. Irish history certainly never has. And when we consider the centuries of division that preceded 1998, we must acknowledge that history is not necessarily on our side. But if we reflect, President, on our history since 1998, we can take enormous encouragement and inspiration. We have closed the bloody chapters, opened a new chapter of reconciliation, of renewal. We cannot rewrite our history, but we can and will shape the future in a different way and in a different image. It would be the image of the Good Friday Agreement, an image of justice, equality, opportunity for all of the people of Northern Ireland, an image of trust, of cooperation, of friendship between nationalists and unionists, between North and South on this island, an image of partnership between Ireland and Britain, an image of respect for each other and of reconciliation with each other. A shared future is being built on the solid foundations laid of the Good Friday Agreement of 10 years ago. Thomas Paine once pleaded, President, ladies and gentlemen, "If there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my child may have peace. After all of the centuries of violence and despair, our children have peace." So let us keep it that way, folks. Thanks for listening to me.